Welcome, everyone, to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and so much more. We have three movies to talk to you about this week. We're going to start with talking about Furiosa, the new movie in the Mad Max saga that does not contain Mad Max. The saga contains Mad Max, but Furiosa does not. Stephen Garrett will be here to talk to me about that. We're going to talk to Gillian Gaar about Back to Black, the new Amy Winehouse biopic. Both Gillian and I are Amy Winehouse fans. We have some thoughts about this film. And Omar Gayaga will be here to talk to me about Hitman, the new movie from Richard Linklater starring Glenn Powell, which will be on Netflix worldwide starting June 7th. And it is terrific, and I really recommend that you check it out. But first, we're going to talk to Stephen Garrett about Furiosa right after this interlude.
I am the great Dementus. I rule the Wasteland.
He took everything from me, my mother, my childhood.
I want them back.
Good for you.
Got a fiendishly high pain threshold.
Magnificent.
I'm Furiosa.
Our supposed blockbuster of the week is Furiosa, a sequel to Mad Max Fury Road, which itself was a sequel to several Mad Max movies from the 80s and 70s, from director George Miller. And Furiosa is a prequel to Mad Max Fury Road. Stephen Garrett wrote a review of Furiosa. He's back from France.
Bonjour.
And I saw Furiosa, as usual, at the Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, Texas. And we're going to talk a little bit about this movie, which I think is pretty good, but it has been a kind of a box office disappointment, which... It took me a little bit by surprise, I gotta say, Stephen, but it makes sense now that I
think. Well, it doesn't make sense to me, so I'm excited to hear you explain it.
Well, here's the deal. If you look at the box office numbers from Mad Max Fury Road, which, you know, people universally agree is one of the great movies, action movies of all time, it actually got crushed at the box office in its opening weekend by Pitch Perfect 2. Which is not one of the greatest movies of all time. It's a sequel.
That other action-packed film about the wasteland, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but
apocalyptic, post-apocalypse.
I've just seen some, you know, reading basically people saying, like, look, Fury Road was great, but it is not, but the Mad Max franchise is not a franchise with, like, the biggest fan base.
Right.
And even Fury Road, it was very successful and universally praised as a great movie. It's still not it's one of those, it's like a franchise for, like, film lovers in some ways. It doesn't exactly have the popular touch. So you're going back to the wasteland for a movie that doesn't even have Mad Max in it. Mad Max is the sort of the entry into the world. They're trying to sort of reboot the franchise around this female action hero, which is a very modern take and very understandable. And you know, this movie's a prequel. Furiosa is a strong prequel to Fury Road. And so my critique of it is that it doesn't really contain any surprises.
Right. I mean, I agree with you there. And I think that's why, I think, look, nobody had any expectations about Fury Road. It was a sequel to, it was a fourth film in a franchise where the last film before it was 1985.
Yeah, 30 years. 30 years. Yeah. And it came out of nowhere and it was amazing. It was fresh and exciting and bizarre and just and really great.
Well, but I think it was fresh and exciting and bizarre, even for those who were intimately knowledgeable and loved the previous three films. Like, it was so strange. I went and looked back after seeing Furiosa. I went back and looked at the first 30 minutes of Fury Road, which arguably or maybe inarguably are the most perfect 30 minutes of any film. The first 30 opening minutes of any film. You know, I mean, it's like maybe Saving Private Ryan, maybe. But like Fury Road, it comes at you so ferociously and with such bizarre, strange originality.
Yes.
And such brutality that you just are breathless until that final moment where, you know, after that, there's that car crash that with the flare in the desert storm, the flare just kind of like goes down to until it ex- extinguishes and the screen goes black and you're just like, what am I watching? It was world building. It was like world building on speed. You know, you're being thrown so many different weird, strange characters and names and visions. And with Furiosa, actually, in a interesting, odd way, it slows down. It maybe presumes that you've already been introduced to these characters, but it does it in a way that makes it more measured and less insane. And I think that's part of the reason why Furiosa just isn't, it doesn't have that bracing slap of originality that Fury Road does. Yeah,
no, it's not as fresh. I mean, that's not to say there aren't some incredibly virtuistic, whatever, how you say that, action sequences that go on and on, especially there's a middle part of the movie where there's a couple of chases that are just incredible.
Well, there's that stowaway, extended sequence, right?
Yes.
Which apparently took 78 days to shoot? Took 9 months to shoot, something like that? I mean, it was like insane. It took a long time for them to put that together, apparently.
That's a long, long desert truck motorcycle hang glider. The gliders. It's just crazy. And so there's some great stuff in this. And the movie introduces a new character played by Chris Hemsworth. He's a bad guy, a very complicated and hammy bad guy named Dementis.
Hammy is the key word. Yeah, he's a very hammy.
He goes way over the top and really like dominates the film because Anya Taylor-Joy, there's a girl who plays the young Furiosa, and then Anya Taylor-Joy takes the Charlize Theron role. And I think she's fine, but she's not Charlize Theron. She's not as good an actor, and she doesn't have the same, she doesn't command the screen in quite the same way. And therefore isn't as interesting. She's not that interesting to watch.
She really doesn't have many lines, and she doesn't have any agency over the events of the film either. So it's an odd main character because of that, you know?
Yeah, and so really, like, you find yourself kind of focusing on Dementis, and he's fun to watch. And I enjoyed – I mean, it's not – he's not going to win any awards for this performance unless it's an award for hammiest action villain. But it was still – he still, like, really enjoyed him. He was really enjoying himself, you know, whereas, you know, everyone else looked kind of hot and miserable. And then you have, you know, the Immortan Joe and his sons Rictus and Scrotus. And there's lots of maggots eating flesh and, like, torture. And so it's not – I can see why Furiosa is just not capturing the imagination like Fury Road did, because it's really like the kind of the – it's like a sequel that is a prequel, and so it doesn't – it's not furthering the story. You want to see what happens next, not what happens before. You know, if this movie had come first, maybe it would feel a little fresher.
I think it would feel a little fresher, but again, like, I think part of the surprise and delight of that Fury Road was being – the way that Max is thrown into an incredibly bizarre kind of adventure and universe of characters and adversaries. To have this kind of very calmly lay it out, it's interesting, but it's not quite as engaging, you know. In a weird way, it's almost like Mad Max, but Road Warrior, in that he's kind of introduced to these worlds and characters slowly until there's this huge that all leads up to a 30-minute, you know, kind of Fury Road style, action piece with a enormous truck being attacked by people. You know, I mean, that's still the signature kind of trope of any Mad Max movie, it seems to me.
An enormous truck fight.
Enormous truck fight.
With flamethrowers and, like, weird white bald guys and, like, who are spraying their mouths with silver spray paint. There's also a lot of cabbages in this movie. I don't know what was up with the cabbages.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of – they just wanted to put that little person on a bed of cabbages, which seemed
a little
offensive, but okay. It's
very offensive. I did it's like
he's a cabbage patch kid. This is odd. Anyway.
I did like the three fortresses set up. I liked the Citadel and Gas Town and the Bullet Farm. You know, I was hoping maybe they could go to the Home Depot if there was still a Home
Depot.
That's
the most terrifying fortress, I think.
I also did like how the movie started out by showing us the whole world. And then hones in on, like, the small segment of Australia, and you realize, like, oh, this isn't the whole world. This is literally just the Australian outback. I found myself wondering, like, what's going on in France? Or, like,
the countries are fine, actually. They're totally fine. It's just Australia that went insane.
How are things in San Francisco? You know, what's happening over there in Beijing? You know, so it's like, or is this just an Australia thing? So, you know, but he showed you basically, like, how incredibly parochial this all is.
Right.
And I think that actually, like, while it was kind of a good perspective, I do think that hurts Furiosa a little bit, because suddenly you're not as in it anymore. You know, you're like, right. Oh, this is just some, like, weird Australian thing.
Or it makes you wonder what the equivalents are in Beijing and in San Francisco and what different flavors, local flavors are, you know, added to this strange.
Yeah. What's happening in this apocalyptic vision. I don't know. I gotta say though, like, I mean, cause I consider this to be the, you know, Furiosa to be the sort of the real start of the summer blockbuster season. And it's kind of off to a disappointing start with that and the Fall Guy and, you know, that's really what we've been given so far. I guess you kind of count the King Kong Godzilla movie as an opening salvo, but this 2024 is not shaping up to be 2023 in terms of its summerness.
No, it's very true, and I guess you could point to the double strikes that happened last year at this time, right? The acting strike and the screenwriter strike. I'm sure that had a dent in production and kind of softened whatever tentpoles might have come out.
Yeah, we're not getting a Barbenheimer. This week we got Furiosa and the Garfield movie. So Garferosa, it's not the same. It's not the same.
I think it's what is on the horizon. There's Horizon on the horizon, which I don't think will be big numbers. But A Quiet Place Day One, right? That'll be big. Of course, Deadpool.
Deadpool and Wolverine. It's like, all right, that's fine. I'll just. You know what? Look, there's a lot coming out right now about how people are not going to the movies anymore. I'm still going to the movies. I'll see anything. I don't care. But like, I feel like an anomaly at this point. And, you know, Furiosa is not the picture that's going to bring us all together in an election year.
I don't think it is, but you know, it's funny also, this is a sequel to a movie that came out now 9 years ago, you know, which was a sequel to a movie that came out 30 years before. These are not movies that are being made by studios that want, you know, big numbers from their franchise. This is absolutely a passion project by George Miller. You know, these are...
And let's be clear again, George Miller is 80 years old and this movie has a lot of energy and is still... it's entertaining, and if you like The World, I don't think you'll be disappointed. So it's kind of amazing that he is still able to make a movie with this much kind of weird zing to it.
Amen. I mean, you know, like, look, the production design and the costume design. I mean, much imagination, so much more imagination in this movie in one frame than there usually is an entire film that, you know,
for sure, sure. So I don't mean to dismiss it just because it's like not quite connecting with the people or whoever they are. It's still got a lot going on, but it is not Fury Road.
I think, you know, what's amazing though too is that, like, I remember when Fury Road came out and just being really impressed by it, of course, but I would not have thought that it would then 9 months later go on to win, like, whatever it was, 6 Oscars or be nominated certainly for 10 or so. And then in conversation even now, like, just have people just acknowledge, like, well, and then of course Fury Road is a masterpiece, you know, or like it's one of the greatest films of the 21st century. And it's so it's hard to get perspective, you know, when you're in the thick of it. And who knows how people will think of Furiosa.
I don't think they're going to think Furiosa is one of the greatest films.
Maybe not.
I think they'll definitely say it's one of the films of the 21st century.
I think they'll say it's one of the great prequels. I think it's hard to thread that needle and make a prequel that's really satisfying.
Well, there's no Jar Jar Binks in it. So,
yeah, you know, I was about to say, unless it's Phantom Menace, which it clearly is unimpeachable. That's like, you know, that's the masterwork.
There is no Jar Jar. I mean, there is Rictus and Scrotus, but
which I think were the universe overlap, right, with Star Wars, Rictus and
Well, it was nice to see Scrotus again because he dies in Fury Road, and it's the same actor showing up, and it's Scrotus. Maybe you can have it. Maybe in the next movie, it's just going to be called Scrotus, and it's
Scrotus, a Mad Mad Saga.
Yeah, Scrotus. Talk about the creation of Scrotus. That's the movie I want to see. All right, Stephen Garrett, I won't call you Scrotus. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, Richtus.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Last week, we briefly talked about the new Amy Winehouse biopic, Back to Black, but we were really more focused on other things and didn't cover it to the extent that I feel like it needed to be covered. And Jillian Garr, frequent contributor to Book and Film Globe and a contributor to Rock and Roll Globe, our sister publication, wrote a review of Back to Black, an excellent review in Rock and Roll Globe. And I wrote, I would say, also a fairly excellent review in Book and Film Globe. And so we are your Back to Black experts. And we're going to talk about this this film a little bit more. Hello.
Hello. Great to be here.
Yeah. So I really liked your review. You know, you write a lot about music. So you had a very informed perspective. I took it from your review that you're quite the fan of Amy Winehouse.
Yeah. I mean, well, I didn't hear Frank because no one in the U.S. heard Frank when that came out because it wasn't released here. But yeah, as soon as I heard, and maybe Rehab was the first song I heard, but you know, I love that 60s girl group era too. So on hearing those songs, that and the beginning of Back to Black, and You Know You're No Good, it just takes you right back to that time that I love. So I knew instantly where she was coming from.
Right. So, you know, I think the music is great as well. There was another critic, I saw a film critic who was referring to her when talking about the movie as a one-hit wonder, which is kind of true in the U.S., but regardless, like she has, you know, she has a huge cultural footprint. She's an icon in the U.K., which is maybe why we keep getting so much Amy Winehouse content and why this movie got made at all, really. But, you know, my thing about Back to Black is that we had a really good Amy Winehouse documentary less than 10 years ago. I think it was called Amy, that told the story as well as any movie was ever going to tell her story.
Yes, yes, I agree. I just, you know, one thing I loved about that movie was how, you know, you don't see any talking heads in the movie. He has footage, and then the person involved in that footage, you hear their voiceover. But it's not just this series of talking heads, which I think is so boring in music documentaries or any documentary these days.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a great movie. And honestly, was one of the main reasons I wanted to see Back to Black at all, because I was interested in the subject matter, because that movie was so compelling. And, you know, Back to Black is, as you pointed out, and as I pointed out as well, is not nearly as good as Amy, you know, not even close. It's kind of a strange movie, right? It's like, it doesn't really show her making music, which is the whole reason we're interested in her.
Yeah. And I think they have this both in the documentary and then this biography I was reading about her, just when she put out Frank, her debut album. And she's doing interviews, and she says herself she wasn't interested in being a big star, a lot of fame. And then suddenly it came, and she has to adjust to that. So I think that's an interesting aspect to look at as well. And, you know, she wasn't one of these people that say are driven and, oh, yes, I want to be a big superstar, and they work for it. And with her, it wasn't like that. And I think that would have been an interesting avenue to explore. Dramatically.
There's a bit of that with her dealing with the paparazzi and, you know, but there's not that sort of, you don't really see the arc. The movie, I think, is more concerned. Well, there's a few things it's concerned with. One, and this is, I thought, was the best thing, was this her relationship with her grandmother, who was apparently like a torch singer and what she calls her style icon. And I found those scenes between her, the woman who plays Amy Winehouse, and Leslie Manville, who plays her grandmother, I found those were pretty affecting and I thought very well acted and pretty well written. And the screenwriter seems to think that the grandmother's death was the main reason that Amy Winehouse spiraled into the addiction cycle she did. So, you know, as someone who's dealt with addiction himself, I found that interesting, but I really wanted to see Amy Winehouse write the songs, right? And we just didn't get that.
Yeah, what fueled her – writing those songs? What drove her to write those songs? I mean, we know obviously the second album, Back to Black, based on her relationship with Blake, but you know, that waxed and waned over that period. It wasn't like one breakup and then she writes the songs.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, the movie purports to be about the making of Back to Black, which is this huge multi-platinum album that won a bunch of Grammys. But you don't really see her making the album with Mark Ronson. You just see her mournfully singing the theme song over a bad montage.
Very well put. Yes. That's all you get of that. And it also makes it sound like, you know, that this album of depression, and certainly there are humorous, depressing songs on it, yes, but there's also some humor and you know, a lot of cleverness. I love You Know You're No Good, which really depicts the Amy and Blake relationship. It's her view of that relationship. You know, it's just such a wonderful, fun song.
The only song you see her writing is one of her songs from Frank, where she's a teenager and she's sitting on her bed in her mom's house and just playing the guitar and kind of coming up with lyrics. And, you know, it was a little corny, but at least it showed her like being a creative person. Like, you got this sense that she was a creative person. And, you know, I just didn't see a lot of that in the rest of the movie. She's just kind of a weird, surly drunk. I will say, I think I liked this movie a little more than you did, because I have to say, like, I found Marissa Abella, the young woman who plays Amy Winehouse, I thought she was quite good and really, like, you know, really chews up the screen. And, you know, let's face it, has a nice pair of gams, and, you know, you see a lot of them. And I liked the guy who played Blake as well. I thought, you know, that sort of scene where they meet cute in the bar or on the pool table, like, they had good chemistry.
Yeah, though I found it hard to believe that Amy didn't know who the Shangri-Las were.
Oh, yeah,
It would have been funny if they delivered that with kind of a wink where she pretends like she doesn't know them so that she can continue flirting with this guy. And then later on, you know, she lets slip that, oh, yeah, I have all their albums.
Right. Of course she knew who they were. But I will say, you know, they had good chemistry. But I feel like the movie kind of, that waxed and waned as well. And I thought that her relationship with her, they totally wasted this father character, who was a huge Svengali-like figure in the documentary. And here it's just like Eddie Marson, like, driving a cab and being like, that's my Amy. She sings a song. I loved her. You know, that's me, Amy. I'm like, come on.
You know, I haven't read this. They say, oh, the family had no input, but the family gave them the rights to use the music. So yeah. I think, you know, that if you're a filmmaker, you're going to bear that in mind. You know, you're not going to want to make the estate unhappy, which is understandable. I'm not even saying that critically. I think anyone would do that. And two, I think they may have been a little more nervous because of how strongly Mitch in particular disliked the documentary, saying he thought it made him the villain, which I don't think the documentary did. But regardless, that's how he felt.
It made him complex. It made him more complex and interesting than he is in this movie. I, you know, in fact, I had to check after the movie, after I came back from watching the movie, if Mitch Winehouse was one of the producers, because I felt like it suffered from something similar to, I don't know if you saw the Bob Marley biopic that came out recently.
No.
But, you know, Ziggy Marley was one of the producers of that. And there was a lot in that movie, too much in that movie, about how Ziggy was Bob's favorite kid. You know, and so I was like, oh, did Mitch produce this? Because I mean, he's not the hero of the story, but he's definitely not the villain. He's just kind of this you know, good guy cipher. I'm Jewish, and one of the things I like about Amy Winehouse is that she was Jewish, right? She came from this large, loving, supportive Jewish family. There's this great scene right at the beginning where they're all kind of standing around on Shabbat singing songs in Hebrew. And there's that element to it. There's a sort of good Jewish girl element, gone bad element to Amy Winehouse, which is one of the reasons why I and lots of Jewish guys find her so appealing. I hate to say it.
Well, she was proud of that heritage. I mean, with this biography I read, when she would introduce herself, she even say that, you know, I'm Amy Winehouse. Winehouse, that's a Jewish name.
No.
So anglicized for England, of course, but still, yeah, that was very much a part of her.
Yeah. So I thought the movie came close on that, and it kind of inched away, like it did with a lot of things. You know, I don't know. What did you think of the main performance? I don't think you were as enraptured by her as I was.
Well, I was just so bored with the film. that. But I was bored with the story. I know I did put in, I said their performances were fine, but what can you do with a script like this? Which is basically what I said. And, you know, I have to ask, did you see it in a movie theater?
Of course. Yeah, I see. I like to go to the movies.
How many people were in the theater?
Oh, 15. It was a small, it was a small theater. It was one of those small, like 36 seaters. And I saw it opening weekend. So,
yeah, it's, is that less than usual would be there, do you think? Or
this was not a big hit. So I don't know. Is it less than usual? I think it's about what I expected for this particular movie. You know, Amy Winehouse, again, you know, not outside of the UK, where I imagine this movie will do okay. She's not an enormous name, right? This isn't the Bob Marley biopic was a big hit, but Bob Marley has a huge international fan base. Elton John has a huge international fan base. You know, Queen has a huge international fan base. Dewey Cox, the hero of Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, huge international fan base. That's a joke, but I'm just wondering, like, after seeing Walk Hard, how can they keep making these musical biopics? They all follow the same formula.
Well, I mean, if you're thinking that, I suppose that they're trying to repeat the success of something like Bohemian Rhapsody, which, you know, I was equally somewhat dismayed by, but I'd seen the We Will Rock You stage show, so I knew what I was going to get coming into the movie. They want, you know, something family friendly, but it made tons of money. So I think people are perhaps trying to jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, and you know, Rocket Man was kind of interesting in some ways, and you know, the Bob Marley. Each movie does have to some extent its own vibe, but I just feel like this is such a it's a small story. She had a short career. And again, the real problem with Back to Black is that there's a better version of it in documentary form already out there.
Yeah. And that had cooperation from her close family, and close friends in that documentary. So you're not just getting outsiders.
Well, in any case, Back to Black will be available on some streaming service very soon. But I really think if you're really interested in Amy Winehouse and her, what I consider to be quite excellent music, Amy, the documentary, which I think came out in 2015, or 2016 is the way to go.
I'd agree. And actually, one of the fun things about seeing this new movie was that as a warm up, I watched the Amy documentary again. So
you were completely soaked in Amy Winehouse. And since you're soaked in Amy Winehouse, you're also soaked in vodka. Boy, does she drink a lot of vodka in this thing. I've never seen some. There wasn't so much vodka drunk in, like, in all of Russian cinema as there was in Back to Black.
Yeah. And, you know, with her eating disorder, that's why it really hit her harder. Because she didn't have the strength to withstand it. In a way, I mean, if you read her story, you wonder how she even made it to 27.
Yeah, exactly. Well, she did, and now 27 is the age. That's the age that musicians have to die. All right. Well, Jillian Garr, thank you so much for talking to me about Back to Black. May the next music biopic be more satisfying for both of us.
Yes, I'll drink to that.
You enjoying your pie?
All pie is good pie. So, am I the right guy to eliminate your problem?
This is good.
Hitman, the new movie from director Richard Linklater, has appeared in cinemas this week. It's going to be on Netflix worldwide on June 7th. And I don't know, maybe it's just me because I'm an Austin resident, Austin, Texas resident, and Richard Linklater and the movie star Glenn Powell are very, very much staples here in Austin. But this movie feels big here. Like, everybody I know is going to see it. And Omar Gayaga, our frequent Book and Film Globe contributor, saw it this weekend at the Austin Film Society, just like I did. Hello, Omar.
Hey, Neil.
How's it going? Yeah. So the Austin Film Society, for people who don't know, is not owned by Richard Linklater, but he has a heavy hand in their programming and in everything that they do. So, yeah. So for them, like, a new Richard Linklater movie is a premium product. So Hitman is playing there. And it's not playing in a lot of other places, even in town, because it's really a Netflix movie.
Yeah, it's very much a limited release. And I mean, I've seen it in a couple of other places. I think it's screened at South by Southwest and a couple of other places. But I think it's just kind of to give locals a taste of kind of the theatrical experience for this film. It's really not intended for theaters, but it played like gangbusters at my screening and people loved it. People really,
oh, yeah,
really enjoyed
well,
it.
Because it's really, really good. Let's not bury the lead. You know, it is extremely entertaining. I will say that I understand why it's a Netflix movie. It's not like heavily cinematic. I mean, there's not like an incredible score, or like sweeping visuals. You know, it's a small movie, but it is a fun and sexy and funny romantic comedy. It really hits everything it's trying to do extremely well.
Yeah, you forget that Linklater. I mean, he's known for Boyhood and Before Sunrise. And all of these kind of, you know, very kind of talky, award-winning, you know, very, very critic-adored movies. But you forget he also did School of Rock. He also did Bernie, which was, a really charming movie, also based on a Skip Hollandsworth Texas Monthly story. So, you know, he's got that sort of populist, feel-good, fun movie, you know, kind of thing in him. He can do that easily, as this movie shows. But we usually associate Linklater with kind of more heavier type of movies. But this one's just a blast. It's just a lot of fun. And just kind of it's like all those sort of mediocre movies you see on Netflix that are trying to be kind of fun, romantic, action-y type, thriller type, you know, kind of noir-y. And they never quite hit that mark. This one hits that mark.
It reminded me in some ways of, I know this is kind of a dated reference at this point, but of Steven Soderbergh's Out of Sight.
Absolutely.
Which starred George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez and is a renowned and beloved movie for, was adapted from an Elmore Leonard novel. So strong source material, but, for the, just the sort of fun banter and the sexual chemistry between the two stars. And I think the same thing is the case here with Glenn Powell, who is a major movie star at this point, I would say. And then Adria Arjona, who I thought was, like you said in your review, she's also terrific. But they're both very sexy. I mean, you know, there is like eye candy for everyone in this movie. You know, Glenn Powell is a stud, and Adria Arjona is extremely beautiful. And they're both just incredibly fun and charming. You know, and you really believe that they're into each other.
If you like really dirtbaggy, scummy looking guys, there's Austin Emilio, sort of at the
third wheel. Oh yeah, he was great. He's fantastic. He was great. And he was the third wheel. He was sort of the heavy. He plays kind of a corrupt New Orleans cop. He was great, because there weren't a ton of supporting characters. Retta from Parks and Recreation, the comedian, and I don't remember his name. There's an Indian guy who plays
Sanjay Rao. Yeah,
Sanjay Rao. They were fun. And then really there weren't a lot of other characters. So basically the story is based on Skip Hollandsworth is a local Austin journalist. He writes for Texas Monthly. He wrote a story about this guy named Gary Johnson, who was a New Orleans philosophy.
Houston. Actually, they changed the setting to New Orleans for the movie.
Okay, but he was a Texas philosophy professor who moonlighted as a fake hitman for the cops. Basically, he would run these sting operations, and so they kind of adapt his story very loosely into this sexy noir comedy.
Yeah, and if you only go by the poster or just kind of the first, you know, I guess 30, 40 minutes of the movie, you're seeing Glenn Powell, you know, who's transforming himself with these, you know, crazy wigs and disguises and, you know, playing these different types of hitmen in order to cater to the people that are trying to, you know, buy his services ostensibly. And you're thinking, like, this is ridiculous. This is silly. This is dumb. That really happened. Gary Johnson really wore those wore disguises and did this in real life. And you see some pictures of him at the end of the movie that Linklater includes, I think, very smartly, because it kind of counters that argument of like, well, this is dumb. You know, no, it really happened.
And I will say that part of the movie is fun, and people were chuckling incessantly during that part of the movie. But the movie really kicks in when Arjona literally steps into the picture. Like she's in sort of she's blurry, and then suddenly she comes into focus, and you know, you see Glenn Powell's eyes light up and our eyes light up, and then the plot really gets going. And it's kind of like a little bit of Coen Brothers, and a little shades of Double Indemnity. you know, there's another classic noir films, but it's done kind of with a light touch.
Yeah, I think Out of Sight is a great comparison. That is one of my favorite movies. And, you know, it's in the same way, you know, it's got great dialogue. It's sexy. They got incredible chemistry from the very first scene that they're together.
Yes.
You're just like, oh, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you saw it. Did you see Anyone But You, the romantic comedy that Glenn Powell did with Sydney Sweeney?
I have not. How was their chemistry?
It was decent. Mm-hmm. You know, again, both very like sexy movie stars. And, you know, they were game. It was Anyone But You is a kind of a wacky modern adaptation of Much Ado About Nothing, set around a wedding in Australia. So it wasn't as good as Out of Sight, you know, but it was good enough. I thought personally, I said Out of Sight, but I mean, of Hitman. I keep calling it Out of Sight because it just reminds me so much of that movie. But what it shows is that Glenn Powell, there aren't a lot of people who Glenn Powell isn't going to have chemistry with.
Yeah, and he co-wrote the script as well. He worked on that with Linklater, adapting the Texas Monthly article. And if nothing else, this movie shows his versatility. I mean, he can play sexy, he can play goofy, he can do...
Tough guy.
I don't know how well people are going to buy him as a nerdy philosophy professor with no game. I don't know if that's going to play.
It's kind of like the 90s teen comedies where the nerdy girl takes off her glasses and suddenly people realize that she's beautiful.
Yeah, it's the Clark Kent glasses thing. Like, oh, he's Superman. Wait a minute. He took off his glasses. But, you know, they try to make him look, I didn't put this in the review, but to me, they were trying to make him look like the boring eco high school teacher that Beavis and Butthead have, the Mr. Andreessen or whatever.
Yeah.
With the hair part of
it. Right. There is an element of like the way his voice is all kind of like, yeah, it's kind of like Clark Kent, Christopher Reeves, Clark Kent in the original Superman movie. So there's an element of that. I will say, like, you know, you mentioned this is a Linklater movie. There are philosophical digressions, which is sort of the hallmark of his movies. You know, there are, long monologues about, you know, identity and the way identity is constructed and, you know, and sort of how the tides of history deal with bad guys. There's a discourse on the id, the ego, and the superego. So it's not a dumb movie by any stretch of the imagination. You could see, you know, the sort of the DNA of Slacker and Dazed and Confused and, you know, and the Before Sunrise trilogy. You could see some of that in there, but it was sandwiched into this, like, you know, terrific, you know, and fun noir comedy. Really, really successful film, I say.
Yeah, if you were to strip those parts out, those monologues and those kind of school lectures, you'd still have a very fun, entertaining movie, but those certainly add some weight to it. And don't ever overstay their welcome. I never saw those scenes and thought, oh, come on, let's get back to the, you know, to the romance or to the hitman stuff. Like
the only one I would say is he has a longish conversation with his ex-wife, and sort of in the middle, and then that character doesn't come back. I mean, it's okay. It establishes his character. That may be the only. I mean, I literally actually got up and went to the bathroom during that scene, and I was actually surprised.
You missed the car explosion right after.
Oh, no, there was no car explosion. That's the thing too. Is like there is. It's a very. It's not a family friendly movie. It's a movie for adults, but it, you know, there's not a lot. There's no blood.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little profanity. It's like it's just clean, grown up movie. And I think it's going to be pretty successful on Netflix because Glenn Powell has an increasing following, and he had Anyone But You, which is a huge hit, and he has a big blockbuster coming up this summer with Twisters.
Yeah, and he was in Top Gun, which was kind of the big launch for him.
I spotted. I was like, oh, that guy.
Yeah, I hope it does well. And I mean, when I say in the review that it's kind of a grown up movie, you know, there's nothing. I mean, it's got sex scenes, but there's nothing really gratuitous about any of that. It's not adult. You know, there's not a lot of language. It's just adult in that it's mature. Like, it doesn't feel pandery. It doesn't feel like it's dumbing down in any way. It's smart, funny, sexy. And just those qualities to me make it feel like a grown-up movie compared to everything else.
And there are rare qualities in a film. And there's plenty of grown-up films that are real drags to watch. And this is not one of them. So, I appreciate Hitman. I know you do. And everyone I've talked to who has seen it so far feels the same way. So let's hope it's not just another one of these like parochial Austin phenomenons, you know, because like I said, you know, when Richard Linklater comes out with a movie, like everyone you and I know is like, they're all crowing about it. They probably know 10 people who worked on it. But I think this has a chance to, like some of his movies do sometimes, find a broader audience.
Yeah, I mean, Out of Sight was not a big hit when it came out, and we still talk about it, and we still reference it as like, ooh, yeah, remember when Clooney and J-Lo were in that movie? I mean, if nothing else, I hope this movie has that sort of long life where people still talk about, oh, remember when Glenn Powell was, you know, not a huge thing yet, and, you know, he made this movie? So I think this movie has the potential to have a long life the way Out of Sight did.
Agreed. May it live long and prosper, as they say. Omar Gayaga, thank you so much.
Thanks, Neil.
All right, thank you so much, Omar Gayaga. Hitman is on Netflix starting on June 7th. We highly recommend that you check it out. As for Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse biopic, your mileage may vary. Jillian Gar was here to talk to me about that movie, and I thank her for that. And it's in theaters now. It should be on streaming very soon. Furiosa is currently in theaters and also probably will be on a streaming service within the next few months. That seems to be how things are going these days. Thanks to Stephen Garrett for talking to me about that movie. And thanks to Stephen in general for being on the show nearly every week and giving me his time and his expertise about film. I also wanted to extend a thank you to our producer, Matthew Sheffer, who does an excellent job putting my incoherent ramblings and bad sound quality together every week to make this excellent show, which is now cleared 150 episodes. We've been doing this for several years, and it just keeps getting better and better, and Matthew is a big part of that. And I also wanted to thank Sea of Reeds Media, our parent company, Ken Kirsten, Kevin Sanders, Melody Kirsten, for all they do to support the show and me and the website and independent media in general. I really appreciate what they do and what the site has become. And thanks to you for listening to the show. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We bring you fresh new content nearly every day, and we bring you this podcast nearly every week, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.